From the Carnegie Tsinghua Center in Beijing, China, this is the China in the World podcast hosted by Paul Hanley.
Welcome back to the China in the World podcast. I'm Paul Hanley, the director of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center here in Beijing. Today, I'm fortunate to be joined by my current Carnegie colleague, Brett McGurk, and my former National Security Council colleague. Brett is in Beijing this week for our China Middle East Carnegie Global Dialogue. We've been discussing the shifting politics of the Middle East, as well as U.S. and Chinese roles in the region. Brett is the former special presidential envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS at the State Department, a position that he held until December of 2018 when he left in protest of President Trump's then decision to remove all U.S. troops from Syria. Brett has served 15 years in senior positions in the government across three different administrations, beginning as serving initially in Iraq and then returning to Washington, D.C., where he served as a director for Iraq and Afghanistan in the Bush White House, where I had the opportunity to work with Brett. He went on to serve as a special assistant to the president and senior director for Iraq and Afghanistan in the Bush administration. In the Obama administration, he served as deputy assistant secretary of state for Iraq and Iran prior to his position as special presidential envoy. Brett is now a distinguished lecturer at Stanford University and also a non-resident senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment. Brett, it's a pleasure to have you in Beijing.
Thanks, Paul. This is great. Thanks for having me.
Brett, I want to talk to you about some current issues, but before we do that, I want to go back a little bit. You know, you're teaching a course at Stanford on presidential decision-making. You've worked for three administrations. You've worked for three presidents, different parties, different styles, different decision-making techniques. I want to talk to you, bring you back to a time when I was serving in the front office in the National Security Council, working for Steve Hadley, who was the National Security Advisor, as his executive assistant. You were working with Megan O'Sullivan on Iraq, and there was very little appetite during, this is prior to 2007, there was very little appetite for increasing the number of U.S. troops. The whole idea was to find a way to get out of Iraq. But you and a few others were arguing that that's not what was really required, that we needed to really actually add additional troops to Iraq. It was a very controversial position. Ultimately, the president agreed to it, and then it was known as the surge. And many have credited it as being the key strategy that allowed the Bush administration to leave Iraq with honor. You played a very important role in that process, and I just want to bring us back to that time. And what was it like? You had your view on this. It was very different than a lot of others. How ultimately did your perspectives win out?
Wow, thanks, Paul. Let me just say, that's a big question going back here.
Yeah.
That's going back almost 12 years. So I'll try to reconstruct it as best I can. First, just how honored I am to be here and see you again here in Beijing. And just you're a total rock star in terms of when it comes to everything in Asia, China, American policy here. And it's such a critical time. I just welcome this opportunity. It's been an incredible week, and I look forward to the conversation.
Thank you.
But, you know, that experience in Iraq does color how I see other issues. Mm. I spent a year in Iraq in 2004. I got there in early January 2004. And
this was prior to coming to the National Security
Council? Prior to coming to the White House. So I saw it up close in a pretty visceral way for a year. And you had a sense very early on that we just had a gap between our objective, the objectives we were trying to achieve and the resources we had devoted to it. And so, you know, I don't have to go through the history, but our country obviously found ourselves in some trouble.
Yeah.
And in the first 2 years in the Bush administration, the NSC, really the first year, 2005 heading into 2006 in this mm-hmm. period, we found from our office at the NSC, working with you and Steve Hadley and Megan O'Sullivan, it was my view that the president was President Bush was very deferential to what he was hearing from his chain of command at the time. And that was one view of the war that...
His military commanders.
The military command. Yeah. And this is a kind of classic model of presidential decision-making and the commander-in-chief authority. You set the big objective, and then you defer to your chain of command, your Secretary of Defense and your commanders. The problem is the war wasn't going very well. And there was always a sense that, well, we're about to turn a corner and that we can transition over to the Iraqis. And it really came to a head in 2006. We had an al-Qaeda bombing in a city, Samarra. A very famous mosque was destroyed. It really unleashed kind of civil sectarian conflict in Iraq. And the thing was really spinning out of control. And so there were a couple options on the table. One was basically just to pull back and let the thing burn out, which I think would have been disastrous for the region and our national security interests. Another was to at least to test the proposition that there was another way to do this, that we could actually put in more resources, change the way the campaign was being fought, focused on concepts of actually securing the population in key parts of the country. So we really developed this concept and tested it analytically. I think we worked very closely with our intelligence community colleagues. I think we built a very sound empirical case that we could make to Steve and others that this would be a big bet if the president were to make it. But I think there's, if you look at the options and the analytical foundation, I think it's more likely than not to succeed. So
and
that's really
the,
what we were
where
doing
was the
at
Defense
the
Department on this, in particular Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, leading up to that? Was against, wasn't he against they wanted a smaller force there and he wanted to let the Iraqis take over?
Rumsfeld had that, certainly had that view that we had to transition to the Iraqis. And I think Secretary Rumsfeld had a view from early in the war that you could do this with small footprint, very light. Going back on whether or not the war should have ever started, which is the major historical question. But I find myself in the middle of it almost a year in early 2004, and then here we are in year three or so. I think that initial conception was just provably false. And we had found ourselves in a situation in which we did not have the resources. So this, the classic element of strategy that I talk about quite a bit and all sorts of things, making sure you align your ends, your ways, and your means. You align your objective with your resource commitment within how are you going to deploy those resources. And if those three elements are misaligned, by definition, you take on risk and you take on the likelihood of unintended consequences and you find yourself in real trouble. So we had to really align our ends, ways, and means, which we did. Of course, Steve Hadley, who I think just kind of is the embodiment of what a national security advisor should do, pulled together the interagency at a very, very rigorous process, developing options, and went to the president. They were debated with the president so that when he made that consequential decision, a lot of work had been done to make sure it could succeed. And then he, President Bush, just changed his, I think, entire conception of really being the commander-in-chief. So the last 2 years of his presidency, I mean, you were there in the NSC, but you saw it particularly from the front office. He was, daily hands-on engagement in terms of overseeing the campaign. We had a meeting with President Bush and a very small meeting of the National Security Council every Monday morning, really for the last 2 years of the administration.
This was during the surge.
Once the surge started.
Once the surge decision was made.
Yes, I'll never forget. I was in Steve Hadley's office. You may have been there. Maybe you had gone home for that. I don't know. Probably not.
Probably not.
But we actually, President Bush made the address to the American people in early January. Announcing to the American people that he had made the decision to send, I think initially 20,000, almost up to 30,000 additional American forces into Iraq, which is a very unpopular decision. But he made this very consequential historic speech, and I was there with Steve, and the president came in the room after the speech, and he said, "Look, we're going to make this work, and I'm going to make sure it works." And I've always thought that was his way of saying, "You know what? I'm done delegating and being deferential. I'm taking command of this war." And the last 2 years, he really did. And I think the turnaround, I think, is really, I think if you look at it historically, it's the decision, but also how the president really led in that period and took charge of the campaign.
But how did, because you felt strongly about this and Megan did as well, but there was, there were, throughout the interagency, this was a controversial idea that we actually have to add troops, not pull troops out. How ultimately did you get that viewpoint? Did you persuade people? How were you ultimately successful in doing that?
Well, when he ran the process, this is why process is very important.
Mm-hmm. And Steve Hadley, as National Security Advisor, as you said, cared very much about that.
But this is why process is important, because the process, the national security decision-making process, does a number of things. It analyzes what's happening in the world. It develops options for the president. And so what we did was developed a series of options and then really tested them through the interagency so that we had a series of very well-developed options with pros and cons. So that when this decision ultimately reached the president, it had really harnessed all the expertise within the U.S. government. Mm. And in terms of a national security decision-making process with real rigor, it really was a model. So what we did from the NSC was try to draw on the experts in the U.S. government, draw on the massive amount of information that, of course, flows through the White House, flows through our inboxes every day, to put together the foundation for what a new policy might look like. Mm-hmm. And also to do the same thing for alternative theories. So an alternative theory was that we should actually reduce our posture right at that time. But you could run the kind of the consequences of that course of action. So I think by the time this came to the president, and he's the decider, he had to make the decision, I think he had a fairly well-constructed package of very difficult decision, Mr. President, but here are the options, here's mm-hmm. how your experts see it, and in my view, he made the right decision at a difficult time.
Let me ask you about another part of your experience when we did not serve together, where I was out of government, but you served as the presidential envoy for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS. And I was thinking back to, and we've talked about this week, June of 2014, when ISIS declared the caliphate, rapidly expanded across the region, seized major cities in Iraq and Syria, like Mosul and Raqqa, spread international terror with bombings and attacks in Paris, Germany, the United States, Turkey, many other places in the world. At the time, people were writing about ISIS in a way, frankly, that was terrifying, documenting its rise and evolution into this force of terror. Today, ISIS does not control territory in Iraq or Syria, and its threat to the region appears to have diminished substantially. This, I want to acknowledge your contributions to this, and I want to ask you, reflecting back now, what do you think made this strategy successful, and what do you remain concerned about as you look forward?
Thanks. So that goes back to the summer of 2014. So when ISIS really took Mosul, broke through western Iraq from Syria into western Iraq at two points, was really converging down in Baghdad. It was the most serious situation I've ever been involved in. I mean,
it seemed terrifying. Were you terrified at the?
Well, I was in Iraq, and yeah. I was up in northern Iraq and came back to Baghdad, and we had a couple of immediate meetings with President Obama, the national security team, and at the time I was a senior person on the ground. And the question would come to, you know, what's the assessment of what's happening? The honest answer was, it's very hard to know what's happening. Mm-hmm. We had very little intelligence overhead. There was like this fog and friction of chaos and rumors. And I was walking down the hall one night to get on a video conference with the president at the time and others, and got a call from a very senior Iraqi official about saying there's about 150 gun trucks approaching central Baghdad, that Baghdad's about to fall to ISIS. And I had no idea whether that was true or not. Mm-hmm. So I said, I want to tell you that when I got in the room to address the National Security Council, here's kind of what is happening. There's a psychological collapse in the country in which rumor is fact.
Yeah.
And I thought we had to do something to be a circuit breaker, to try to shore up the psychology of the country. President Obama, little noted decision, but he sent in special forces very early to kind of go around Baghdad to get a sense of what was really happening. That was quite critical. He then made the decision that we have to fight back here, but he was very clear with us that he wanted to put guardrails on the policy so that we didn't slip into something that we didn't set ourselves onto a slippery slope in terms of Middle East war that we wouldn't be able to find ourselves. We'd find ourselves over-invested.
Creep,
over-invested. Right? So some principles that went into the campaign, and building on a lot of lessons learned, very difficult lessons learned from the Iraq and Afghanistan campaigns, American forces would not be doing the fighting in Iraqi and Syrian cities and towns. We would do this with a large international coalition with a broad base of international legitimacy, bipartisan congressional support, very well-resourced campaign. President Obama was also very clear that we were in the middle of the Iraqis were forming a new government. He wanted to have an Iraqi government that the world could really rally behind. Mm-hmm. So we put these elements in place over the summer of 2014. That was the foundation of the campaign. And then it was really just kind of week by week, month by month, executing the campaign. Extremely difficult. We actually had a pretty good transition. I hope historians will note this when they look back. Between Obama and Trump in that transition on this critical issue. Mm-hmm. There was continuity in key personnel. I was one of them, but more importantly, Joe Dunford, our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, right. Our CENTCOM commander, our main military command obviously stayed in place. Special Forces chain of command the same. So we had real continuity. We ran a strategic review with Secretary Mattis at the time and Tillerson, and we teed up some key decisions for President Trump to make, which he made. That allowed us to accelerate some things. So I think the campaign that was built under President Obama carried forward under President Trump was a real success.
Transition's a key. And in fact, in the Bush administration, you remember President Bush also put a huge priority in making sure that that transition with the Obama administration was smooth and that they're on critical issues, that we brought in the key information and knowledge to the Obama administration. And I talked to Obama administration's officials who say they remember how it was done under President Bush and they wanted to do this.
Those transitions are interesting because you stayed on.
I did.
Stayed on. And it's really, it goes from the West Wing on one day.
Yeah.
You know everybody there. All the photographs on the wall, which are replaced every couple of days, are all President Bush. And then a day later, everything changes. Totally new people. But some familiar faces. So you were there. Right. Doug Lute stayed. Some key people stayed. But I think that transition was also handled pretty well.
The thing that I remember very vividly is that on January 21st, after President Obama was inaugurated, you come into the office, your computer is completely zeroed out, and your filing cabinet is empty.
Right. Starting from scratch.
So you're starting from scratch. And fortunately, I emailed some critical and key documents to my friends at the State Department and Department of Defense and said, send them back to me on January 21st. But you're really pretty much starting from scratch.
Yeah.
That was difficult. Let me fast forward to December of last year. You left, resigned from the Trump administration over this decision to withdraw completely from Syria. You published a piece in Foreign Affairs where you discussed the troubling implications of this decision in terms of withdrawing military U.S. presence from Syria. As somebody who engaged closely with President Trump and the administration, what do you think was behind this decision? What do you think the implications of this decision are? And where does it leave the anti-ISIS coalition that you and your colleagues worked so hard to construct?
So, a number of things there to unpack. I think overall the counter-ISIS campaign has been successful, and I think it's critical now that we see it through. I can talk about the situation in Syria. I think it's positive that the president seems to have at least revisited what had been the decision to get out on a fairly rapid time frame. That seems to have been slowed down. I think that's good for all the reasons I've discussed in Foreign Affairs and the Washington Post and elsewhere.
In part, could have been due to your resignation and Secretary of Defense Mattis, who left at the same time.
You never know. But Mattis, of course, the same week. Mm-hmm. Because it was a decision that was made so suddenly and was totally this is why process matters. It was totally contrary to the policy that had been set in place through the national security decision-making process from the National Security Advisor. And we had conveyed assurances to our coalition partners, and as the leader of the coalition, that was my job, not only in capitals, but also on the ground, our fighting partners, people I know who have fought and died, and their friends and colleagues who are still in the middle of the campaign. Suddenly, everything I had been telling them changed. So,
it's damaging to U.S. credibility.
Well, it's damaging to credibility, the value of American handshake, which is really what I think gives us strength around the world. The one asymmetrical advantage the United States really has vis-a-vis some of our global competitors, like right where we are right now, is our ability to lead and build coalitions and build alliances. And so to have a sudden shift like that I just concluded that myself personally, I couldn't be effective in carrying out this new policy. And I was planning on leaving the administration in the spring, so I didn't try to make a big deal out of this. But clearly, if this was the policy shift, then someone else would need to carry that out. My successor is Ambassador Jim Jeffer. He's doing everything he can.
Well, we worked with,
of course,
the National Security
worked with Jim for well over a decade.
He's been out here on the same program that you've been out here.
Yeah, no, Jim's terrific, and they're doing everything they possibly can here to hold the thing together. And we'll see. But it's a difficult situation northeast here. We got we kind of control a part of the country. Control is a long, strong word. We don't control anything, but we have influence over a third of the country. We built a force of 60,000 Syrians. They're holding tens of thousands of former ISIS fighters and their families. Resources are very strapped, and it's a question of where it goes from here. I think it's. I think we face a pretty high risk situation in the coming months.
You mentioned these centers or these facilities where you have a number of these radical elements that are still there. You called them, I think, jihad universities or something like that, but. I mean, how much of a threat is this? And do you believe that the gains that you were able to make in beating back ISIS will be able to hold over time?
So I don't think you will ever see an ISIS like in 2014. That was just a unique circumstances coming together. 40,000 people from around the world pouring into Syria to join these groups in the cauldron vacuum of the civil war and a number of reasons that happened. So those circumstances, I think, are behind us. But ISIS will remain clandestine cells, insurgent-type networks. What really is concerning now, and this goes back to the lessons learned, and in the campaign, we tried to, again, apply all the lessons learned from Iraq and Afghanistan. One of the key lessons is you do not want to have people indoctrinated with this ideology warehoused in makeshift prison facilities. And that's what's happening now in northeast Syria, simply because so many people came out of this last pocket of ISIS in the tens of thousands. And the SDF, the force we work with, really doesn't have the resources to manage this. This is a major international problem. And that's one reason I think we have to stay in the ground for a while to make sure that this is managed. It looks like the Iraqi government might be willing to take some of them. There's a number of options here, but we don't want to be in a position 10 years from now where the next Baghdadi, it turns out, was in one of these camps. And so it's a real counterterrorism challenge, a challenge for the coalition, and a challenge for the whole international community.
You described this week some of the previous leaders of ISIS and other radical elements have come right out of these camps that you're describing.
Well, of course, the prison camps we used to have in Iraq, the detention facilities, but you just go back in history. Zarqawi used to be in a Jordanian prison. Ayman al-Zawahiri was in an Egyptian prison. So you got to think about who these people are. The unique situation in northeast Syria is that this is a part of the country that we have influence over, and so we have some influence over what's going to happen to these people. And it's extremely difficult because there are families and young children who've been caught up in this. So you need the Red Crescent societies and the UN and the NGOs, and but a real pooling of international resources. And President Trump has made clear he does not want to spend U.S. taxpayer money on stabilization activities in northeast Syria. For example, the city of Raqqa, which used to be the headquarters of ISIS. I've been to Raqqa a number of times when I was in my former official capacity. Just one of the most daunting challenges imaginable when you stand in Raqqa and you see this destroyed city. And I was always of the view, we have to spend some money here to make sure that the demining activities, water, basic resources to get people back to their homes. But President Trump was very clear there will be no U.S. money going into these activities. I think that's mistaken. We were able to go to the coalition and raise about $300 million, so that filled the gap, and that was positive. That came out of our relationship with these capitals, so the coalition stepped up. But now, again, you talked about ends, ways, and means. I mentioned that in the going back to the Iraq example. I think our Syria objectives is a point in my foreign affairs article that just came out. We have a lot of very ambitious objectives in Syria. And we have a misalignment between our objectives, our resources, and how we're going to actually employ them. And that, by definition, means risk.
Let me ask you about the Trump administration's broader policy in the Middle East region. We have seen a move to a different approach and different posture than the Obama administration. There's been a doubling down of our allies like Israel. We saw President Trump decide to move our embassy to Jerusalem to recognize Israel's position on the Golan Heights. Also doubling down with Saudi Arabia, where there's been U.S. unconditional support to the Crown Prince. At the same time, a move, much more confrontational posture with respect to Iran, withdrawing from the Iran deal, the JCPOA, and recently designating the Revolutionary Guards as a terrorist organization. How would you characterize U.S. policy to the Middle East? Are we withdrawing? Is this part of a broader U.S. global rebalance? If so, how does it fit into that? What is the Trump administration's policies and approach to the Middle East?
Well, I think it's a big question, and nobody's really sure. So it's a little disjointed. I mean, on the one hand, we have a very aggressive Iran policy. I think we're building up a lot of economic leverage against the Iranians. I think that's good because I think there are things you have to work to deter. But we've also found that pressure against the Iranians is most effective when you have allies and partners with you. And right now, it doesn't seem that we have that. There's also the question of what is the objective from building up this maximum pressure on Iran? So, and Pompeo's laid out a number of very ambitious objectives. This gets to, again, in the ends, ways, means mismatch. So it's a little unclear. I think the pressure on Iran is good. It's a question of how you're going to use that and trying to make sure you have allies and partners with you. There is this pervasive sense that we were withdrawing from the region. And I think there's some truth to that, but we're, as I
mentioned, pervasive sense from those in the region.
In the region, and you even hear it here from the point here I tried to make on the panel was, look, that's not really true. I mean, if you look at how we are invested militarily from Bahrain to Qatar to UAE to Iraq, where we have about 6,000 American forces, plus a coalition of 22 other contributing partners. And we have just longstanding relationships in the region that aren't going to go anywhere. At the same time, we haven't had ambassadors in major capitals. We haven't had an ambassador in Cairo, in Ankara. We have an interregnum period here now in Baghdad. No ambassador in UAE, no ambassador in Doha. General Abizaid, I think, is just getting out to Riyadh, which is good.
But that's not a problem just to the Middle East. You see that across the
Right. So there's a sense of America receding. Now, and again, I counter that. I think that's a little bit overstated.
You describe it as a rebalance.
I think there's a rebalancing going on, which is natural. I think the American people are very clear. They don't want to be overinvested in these parts of the world. I think President Trump reflects some of that. I think, frankly, President Obama reflected some of that. So they both see the same problem. It's the solutions can be very different between Obama and Trump, to say the least. But I think this also opens up opportunities here for our strategic competitors. So China, where we are, we've been talking about this throughout the week, China's positioning itself in the Middle East, which I think is kind of an undercovered story, but it's quite significant one. Russia has played a fairly weak hand in coming in to support the Assad regime, but by demonstrating, and this matters in the Middle East, that we're going to stand by our partners, come hell or high water. Russia has really, I think, strengthened its overall partnerships and influence in the region simply by that one principle. And when the Arab League met just a month ago, you had the Russian deputy foreign minister there meeting with all the other Arab League leaders. You had just a kind of a parade of leaders from the region going to Moscow and vice versa because Russia came in and said, we're going to stand by our partner. Again, why the decision without any preparation or preparation with our allies and partners that we're simply going to leave Syria after we told them something totally different. Right. I think it's like a butterfly effect. It carries longer term consequences that you might not see right away. So there's a lot of questions, Paul, about what our long-term objectives here are in the Middle East and how we're aligning our ends, ways, and means as we look going forward.
You mentioned China. And we've had discussions this week with Chinese government officials and scholars. But before we talk about those, I want to get a sense from you, from your experience working in the Middle East prior to coming to China on this trip. How did you observe Chinese involvement? How would you characterize China's approach from your perspective, having worked as a senior official in the U.S. government?
So it was always there and somewhat peripheral, but that started to change in 2016. It changed, I think, quite significantly over the last 12 months or so. I think if you go back to President Xi's speech in Cairo in January 2016, he lays out a fairly ambitious strategy for China's engagement in the Middle East. And you can now see how they have kind of carried that forward. Mm-hmm. That same month, they declared having a comprehensive strategic partnership. That's China's highest level of diplomatic status, which we've talked about throughout the week here. In January 2016, with both Iran and Saudi Arabia. And
rivals.
And they and the same trip, and I give President Xi Jinping credit, he went to Saudi Arabia, went to Iran, said, you are both our comprehensive strategic partners. That was January 2016.
That seem like a high-wire act to you, to do something like that?
It's a definite high-wire act. I think mm-hmm. the Chinese know they're on a high-wire act, but they're, and we heard this throughout the week, we heard this at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs yesterday, they believe they found a kind of a new formula for the Middle East. So they've positioned themselves, I think, fairly wisely with four comprehensive strategic partnerships, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and UAE. And so that's the highest level diplomatic status with those four key pillars in the Middle East. And they are now describing their approach as basically being, we're here to invest economically. We're not going to be involved in your internal affairs, which I think a lot of the governments in the region like to hear. So this is classic win-win. If you go back to Xi's speech in Cairo in 2016, we don't see China, we don't see the Middle East region as a sphere of influence. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at their investments since then, I think you could that statement is somewhat questionable. We're not looking to fill vacuums, which is taking a shot at us. This idea that the U.S. is leaving a vacuum, which again I don't think we really are, and we're not going to work with proxy groups. But by the kind of blank check support they give to Iran, which works with proxy troops throughout the region, they kind of are. So and not being an expert on China domestic affairs, but in seeing them operate in the Middle East, my questions here throughout the week have been, look, everything in the Middle East is about politics and divisions and history. And I just find it a little bit naive to believe that there's some new formula here that's going to work. Mm-hmm. And I think the Chinese are playing a fairly shrewd, smart, long-term game. But eventually, they are going to have to take sides on some issues as they develop. They're the second largest trading partner now with Israel, and they're also a comprehensive strategic partner with Iran. So the questions I've been asking here throughout the week, Paul, and you've been there is, okay, got it. You got a new level of influence. You got access in places that the United States does not have access to. How are you using that? How do you intend to use that influence?
On the question of whether or not it's sustainable, the responses this week I would describe as a bit mixed. You know, I've been asking similar questions and have a similar perspective as you do, but you hear not just from Chinese observers, but even Western observers that, you know, maybe it is sustainable. Maybe the Chinese don't see the same contradictions we do because we're looking at it through a Western lens. How do you react to something like that? Is that possibly the case? I mean, you describe it as a shrewd and smart strategy, but what your question is that you're not quite sure it's sustainable, that over the long term they're going to have to take sides, or they're going to have to get into these difficult, contentious issues. Is it possible that they won't?
I'm basing this on my own experience in the Middle East and mm-hmm. reading about the Middle East for a long time, and all my studies and everyone thing. To come into the Middle East region and have a view that we can stand astride all this history and all these intractable problems. That's an interesting theory of the case. I think that's going to be difficult to implement over time. And so we'll see. I think China, as its investments grow, it'll have to become more engaged in some of the more tricky aspects of Middle East politics and policy. Mm. And the question is, how do they use that influence? I think that can be a very negative development for the region mm-hmm. or a more constructive one. But I think the jury is still out.
A couple of the interesting points I heard this week, One in particular is that China may see itself and its position as getting along with everyone and taking this neutral position differently than the region sees China. And in some cases, you know, Israeli observers had noted that they don't actually see China neutral on the Israel-Palestinian question. Many see China as more pro-Palestinian. On the question of what's been going on in Syria, many see China as not neutral on the question, but actually supportive of the Assad regime. And so I think there is a perception gap between how China sees itself and how some in the region might see China. And I agree with you that over the long term, I'm not sure how sustainable this is. I think this will only become more exacerbated over time, especially as we rebalance in the region and China becomes more dependent on the region. China talks a lot about, Brett, its Belt and Road Initiative as an area where it can contribute to providing stability, that countries are welcome, that they welcome the Belt and Road and China's efforts to provide development and infrastructure. Do you see the Belt and Road as something that will have a significant impact on the landscape of the Middle East and the dynamics of the Middle East?
Well, I thought one observer said in one of the meetings that the if you look at what China's doing through the Belt Road Initiative, they are actually using it to create kind of new global norms and a new status quo. So on the one hand, it's described as basic, just infrastructure investment and win-win, but is actually, whether intentionally or unintentionally, is really anchoring themselves in key parts of the world. And of course, the Middle East is what we're talking about here, is really critical. I think the question for the United States, I do not think the United States will be able to stop this trend line. Mm-hmm. For one reason, some of our closest partners and allies want it. So I've heard that in Abu Dhabi, in Riyadh, or even in Jerusalem.
They want the benefits of the Belt and Road, the infrastructure.
They want this investment. Mm-hmm. China, of course, needs the natural resources from the region, whereas right now we don't. So there are structural reasons for this kind of rebalancing that we're seeing.
Over half of China's energy imports come from the Middle East.
Right, whereas we are now the largest oil producer and don't need – it's just a total – like right. The structural shifts are tectonic. But this is a conversation I think we have to have with our allies and partners. Mm. So, okay, if the Chinese are coming in to help run the Haifa port in Israel. What are you saying? What are our Israeli partners? What are our Saudi partners? What are our Emirati partners saying to the Chinese when they also have an audience with Bashar al-Assad and with the Supreme Leader in Tehran? So, and the answer we heard from some Chinese officials is that, well, we're not going to get involved in those issues.
Right.
But as you said, if you are supporting the Assad regime, both in bilateral ties and in the UN Security Council, you are taking a position. If you are the second largest trading partner with Israel and you are not pressuring the Iranians when you have your audience with them as your comprehensive strategic partner to stop the import of missile technology and other things that we know the Iranians have been doing in Syria, which is raising the risk of a state-on-state conflict between Israel and Iran in Syria, well then, you know, what's the point of having that access and that comprehensive strategic partnership? Mm-hmm. So I think these are very important questions that our allies and partners might ask of the Chinese even more effectively than we can. What I tried to do, particularly in my meetings at the with some of the, you know, the Chinese officials here, is just to ask them, are there things that, mm-hmm. such as this, when you have access with the Iranians, do you raise some of these issues? What is your policy towards Bashar al-Assad and reconstruction and other things?
You gave some concrete examples of where China could contribute in a pretty constructive way.
Well, make the case that I understand that, you know, your president made the strong case you don't support proxies, not what this is about, but one of your comprehensive strategic partners is supporting proxies in Syria, and which is very threatening to another partner of yours, particularly the Israelis. So that might be an issue you raise with the Iranians, and that would be something where, I mean, our economic pressure on the Iranians and diplomatic pressure might get a result that I would think would help actually stabilize the Middle East, which is a mutual objective of China and the United States. We, of course, have a Chinese-American citizen that is being held wrongfully detained in Evan Prison in Tehran.
This is the Princeton researcher.
Right. And I've dealt with this issue in my official capacity before he was detained, but with some other Americans who were wrongfully really held hostage by the Iranians. I think our governments are working towards this. I don't have any insider information, but that's the kind of thing. Speak publicly about it. Put some pressure on the Iranians there. In terms of the counter-ISIS campaign, and China says they have a real concern, and it's a legitimate concern about ISIS fighters who might make their way back here or have linkages here.
To Xinjiang?
We have huge reconstruction challenges in Iraq and in Syria. I know Syria is a more difficult case for them, but in Iraq we have a reconstruction program which is overseen by the World Bank, by the United Nations. We had a big international reconstruction conference in Kuwait a couple years ago. China was there. Their contribution was actually quite meager. So I know Mosul is not on the one belt, one road, but it might be a place in which actually some investment, I think, would be welcomed by the Iraqi government, welcomed by the people of Mosul, and really essential. So there are some areas were China to be a little bit more active, I think it would actually resound to our benefit, and we might find some convergence of interests. But for them to just try to remain out of all this stuff and neutral, I think that's going to be difficult for them to sustain over time.
Brett, this is this trip to visit us at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center was your first visit to China. You've had an opportunity this week to talk to academics, scholars, business leaders, diplomats, government officials, students to sort of better understand China, its objectives, priorities. As you prepare to return to the U.S., I'm just wanting to get a sense of some of your big takeaways, some of the things that maybe have surprised you and some of the things that you've learned during your time here.
Well, first, to see up close what you're doing and what Carnegie Beijing is doing is quite extraordinary, Paul. I mean, just the access you have, the relationships you've built, I think is really important. So far more important people than me will pass through your doors. But this is a critical time here for the U.S.-China relationship, obviously. I think it's one of the most important issues in the world. You had Graham Allison here at this table not long ago talking about the Thucydides gap and you know, how do we manage this and try to avoid a conflict, which is always a possibility, which I think would be disastrous. So I think what you're doing here is really quite important. So one thing I take back is just the kind of pride knowing what Carnegie's doing and the good hands it's in with you. It is really quite something. Look, it was great to hear the perspective from Chinese officials, business leaders, scholars about their emerging role in the Middle East, which is something I've been seeing and thinking about for some time. And I think really when I go back, I really came here to listen, and I'll go back with some ideas in terms of where this might be heading. But it'll also inform my trips just as a private citizen now and as a scholar when I go back to the Middle East and talk to some of my former colleagues there, because I have a pretty good perspective here after being here for the week, and I'm very grateful that you provided the opportunity.
Well, it's great to have you out here. It's great to be colleagues again, and I really mean it. I think you know, the contributions that you've made in your roles over three administrations has left our country in a safer position, and for that we can all be grateful. So thank you very much for coming out here really quite shortly after your departure from government. And we're glad to have you out here. Best of luck, and we hope to have you out here again.
All right, come visit Palo Alto.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining the China in the World podcast. Be sure to check out more content from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center on our website.